This is an interview with Mr. William Crawford, Jr. by Mark Dittmer for the Einstein. Okay. First thing I'd like you to do is warm up. The United States involvement in World War II, and I understood that you got into the Army Air Force prior to Pearl Harbor, and why was this?
Well, I had been going to school at Youngstown College, and it was also just immediately after the Great Depression. And the employment opportunities were not too great. And I had some difficulty at that time raising enough finances to keep up with my education. And so I worked in New York City for 1 year after I was out of high school before I started to college.
What year is this?
And this was in 1936 and 1937. At the same time, I had become involved in private aviation. I had taken some private flying lessons, and I had difficulty in trying to finance my private flying lessons as well as my education. So I did have some interest in aviation. So I saw that the getting into flying, into military flying, could serve two purposes. I could further my education in flying, I'd get some military training, and I could also then plan on finishing my education. So really I had several motives, prompted one by the Depression, number two by the financial situation of my family, and number three by the what we felt would be an upcoming war. Now keep in mind this was in late 1937 and 38. And yet we weren't involved in the war until December of 1941. However, there were indications 4 or 5 years prior to the war that there would be some sort of conflict with Japan.
And, well, up until Pearl Harbor, it seemed that negotiations were tense, but it didn't seem like we were going to have a tech. Now, do you think, as you were in that training period, that if it wouldn't have been Pearl Harbor, it would have been somewhere else, or?
Well, keep in mind, although I indicated, there were some indications there would be hostilities with Japan as long as 4 and 5 years prior to the war started. I did intend to join the military even if there was not any hostilities. Going to war was not my motivation. I was not particularly interested in going to war. My motivation was getting into the military and have them teach me how to fly and then further my education. So actually, when I signed up for the military, there really wasn't an Air Force at that time. They had what they called a branch of the service, a U.S. Army Air Force. It was not a separate entity as it's known now. And so actually, I applied for aviation training. Now keep in mind, there was no Air Force at that time, and there was no Air Force Academy. So I could not apply for an Air Force Academy position. It wasn't available. During that period of time, I had accumulated about 3 years of college credits. And therefore, I qualified academically for the so-called Air Force. However, we had to join what they called an Air Force Cadet Program, which was the forerunner of the Air Force Academy. So I actually signed up to become an aviation cadet. And no sooner had I signed up for that and became involved in the pre-testing criteria that the advent of war came about, which in effect shortened up that military training and condensed what was to have been 5 years of cadet training, military training, particularly as related to flying, condensed it into about 1 year.
Okay.
So I had actually signed up for the U.S. Army Air Force Cadet Program in August of 1941. And of course, war wasn't declared until December the 7th. I had no intentions at the time I signed up for the Air Force cadet program that I would actually be fighting in a war.
Well, let's talk about the mood of the country at that time. Well, being in the military, you must have had more or less an end of what was going on in Europe and more close view of what was going on in Europe. How did you feel at this time? And
well, actually, during that period of time, at least my feeling and the feeling of those that I was associated with, that is my family, my relatives and friends, did not view a global war, or the big war as it turned out to be. We all recognized from our studies in school that Japan had expansionist tendencies. However, I don't think anyone realized that they were going to pursue the war as they did. And we all felt at that time that the war in Europe would be confined to continental Europe. And the United States really sort of had an isolationist posture at that time. And so did we actually feel that we in the United States would be involved in a war in 1941 or 1942? I don't think so. I don't know. I didn't. I had no feeling in that way. We were concerned about Japan's attitude, and we were concerned about the attitude of the Germans. But keep in mind, we in this country had just come out of a Great Depression. And things were starting to look good for us. The stock market had rebounded, the job opportunities were opening up, and industry was doing well. And people were really preoccupied with making the industrial giant of the United States expand and grow, but there was not too much thought at that time, in the late 30s, of actually being involved in the war. We were hoping, really, that someone else would fight it for us.
Okay, where were you on December 7th, and how did it affect your training period?
Well, in recollecting, I had already signed up for the aviation cadet program and had been to Columbus, Ohio, and had been inducted and had all my pre-testing and training completed, and I was waiting for a civilian assignment within the Air Force wherever they chose to send me. And I was actually back in my home in Niles, Ohio on December the 7th, and when we heard the news on the radio that Japan had bomb Pearl Harbor. Actually, it didn't strike me at the time that I would be involved so quickly. It didn't seem to register at all. I felt so there was a surprise attack, and all Japan was trying to give us a message. And that message was that even though Hawaii was thousands of miles away from Japan, that Japan could get there if they ever wanted to. We thought it was more or less of an object lesson, rather than the beginning of a big war. So actually, I was at home, and I didn't give it too much thought. However, it was only 4 days later that apparently our government had considered it much more serious than some of the rest of us had. And I was notified then that I was to report immediately to Columbus, Ohio for assignment. And I went into a hurry-up type of military training program. In repeating, I indicated the program was almost 4.5 to 5 years. And from August of 1941 until December the 15th of 1941, we became so desperate that we shortened that program into less than 1 year, actually 9 months. So we had we worked on our program literally 24 hours a day around the clock to shorten up the activities. So here I was, I knew how to fly a civilian aircraft, small civilian aircraft, when war was declared. And within 3 months, I was flying the best trainers that the Army had. And within 6 months, I was flying the largest airplane that they had in the entire Air Force. Now that was not because of my innate ability or my intelligence level. That was due to the urgency surrounding the situation due to the climate war.
Okay, let's talk about your training period. What was it like? What did you go through? And
the training period, I enjoyed it because I enjoy being with people. We were small groups. The military training I had was in a group no larger than Well, the entire population on the base wasn't over 300. The number of pilots in training on that base was something like 35. So it was a close-knit family.
Where was this located at?
This was, my training took place all in California, in three principal cities. I had my primary training, that's my early training, in Visalia, California. Spent 2 months there. Then I spent 2 months in Merced, California. And then my final training prior to going overseas was in Stockton, California.
So what was a typical day like during this?
Well, the typical day started about 5 o'clock in the morning. And we had our academic work until noon, with literally no breaks. And then after lunch at noon, we went through our pilot training as opposed to the academic training. Keeping in mind at that time that we were also schooled in many related subjects to flying. We were taught geography, advanced geography. We were taught meteorology. And we were taught navigation. And at the same time, then we were taught the configuration and the makeup of some of the military aircraft so that the pilots during in-flight missions could attempt to make some minor repairs to the craft if possible. So every morning we had this type of training, our academic training and our technical training. Then in the afternoon we had our manual flying activities. Our day was, as I indicated, about 5 o'clock in the morning until dinner in the evening, which was at 6. Then at 7 o'clock, we then went through a series of reviews covering the day's work. So we literally had a test, as we might know it now in college or in school. We literally had a test from 7 o'clock till 10 o'clock every night on what we had learned during the day. Now, the purpose of this was to accelerate this program and condense it because they were in desperate need of pilots. They were trying to get us through complete training and flying school with all the academic credentials, trying to get us through in 7 months. They succeeded in getting us through in 8 months.
Okay, let's move into your book now, which was Gore and Glory, which was published in 1944.
Right.
And this is more or less a recollection of your times from the time that you set sail in July of 1942 till you're coming back in July.
Oh, you did read the book. You know a lot of things.
Yeah, I did read the book. And let's start with the beginning. Now, for you to do a book like this, did you keep a log or at the time? Or
no, we have to put things in perspective. And I'm not trying to be humble, but by the same token, I don't want to leave the impression that everything I did was special. Timing was all important. You must remember that early in the war, in December of 1941, when war was declared, up through 1942, the United States hadn't really got into the war. We had declared war. We were trying to fight a war, but we weren't prepared to fight a war. Our industrial complex hadn't been geared up as yet to meet the needs of a war. As a result of it, we had very few aircraft. We had very few pilots. And I'm speaking of the Air Force, the air activity. We got into the infantry. They had the same type of problems, but I can only relate to the flying activities. So we didn't have enough aircraft, we didn't have enough pilots, we didn't have enough bombardiers, we didn't have enough navigators. And so there were so few of us involved that anything we did was publicized and glorified. Now keep in mind that the civilian population was greatly concerned about being in war. We had no victory, so to speak, of in 1942 and early 1943 to brag about. We were still gearing ourselves up to war. So the newspapers and the magazines needed something to talk about. We couldn't talk about a victory in the Philippines. We didn't have any. We couldn't talk about a victory in Hawaii. That was a disaster. We had nothing positive to talk about as far as what our people were doing in the war. We hadn't done anything. We were involved, who hadn't won any battles yet. So how did they compensate for that? They picked a few of us and watched our activities. And anything we did that was noteworthy, they recorded and publicized. So I had the advantage, if you might want to call it that, of every time I made a move, someone was watching. And since they needed something to write about to satisfy the population back here in the United States, to satisfy those people, then they had to write about it and glorify it. Now, they have not exaggerated. They didn't create missions for me. They didn't write that I bombed targets that I didn't really bomb. But if I had been in the war, perhaps in 1944 or 1945, I would have been one of maybe 50,000 people they could have written about. I just happened to be in the war early in the ballgame, where there were so few pilots and so few accomplishments that anything we did was noteworthy. So it was timing and not personal achievement so much.
Okay, there's parts of the book I want to go through. Now, the first part, when you set sail from San Francisco to join the 19th Marine Bombardment, the 5th Air Force in New Zealand. Now, you recalled some experiences of going over. I'd like you to rehash some of those from your initial standpoint.
Well, we left the west coast of the United States on a converted freighter. Well, actually, it was converted passenger liner into what they call a troop transport. Now, this was not a large vessel, and there were as many qualified nurses aboard as they could round up that fast after war was declared. There were some pilots and some navigators, some bombardiers, and there were a few Marines. There were a mixture of all branches of the service. In other words, they had policed the United States and grabbed what few people that they had a record on that was qualified to serve, and gathered them together. Now I say that opposed to later on where all the Marines were aboard one vessel and all Navy personnel another and all Air Force another. At that time it was a mixed bag of tricks. So we did have a wide variety of people with different occupations, military occupations, aboard that vessel, which made it very interesting.
Weren't there close to 1,200 people on the ship?
1,200 people on the ship, but there must have been 30 or 40 different occupations, military occupations, represented. Now, the trip was not as boring as it may sound. The Japanese actually had infested the waters off of California. And, of course, we went toward Hawaii and then over toward the Philippines. Well, the entire Pacific Ocean was infested with Japanese mines and Japanese submarines. And so we were in a state of constant alert where you could never get bored. We never found ourselves looking for something to read or wishing the days would go faster. We were excited and there was always some activity. We could see the mines in the water. We could see the missiles being fired that would miss us, submarine missiles that would miss us. So there was that type of activity all the time. Secondly, the war was a novelty. And the crew of the ship treated the military people on board great. I can't say that lasted very long, but it was great early in the war. And as a result of it, why, the food was great and plentiful. The atmosphere on ship was crowded. We lived in hammocks, stacked four or five deep. We slept in hammocks four or five deep. But it wasn't bad at all. But I say the thing that made the time go so rapidly was the fact that we were constantly listening to the radio and listening to the war activities on the radio and watching for the Japanese mines and Japanese submarines. So it was rather uneventful. We had seen a lot of activity and our vessel had stopped, and some nights we didn't move at all, not to stir up the waters and to avoid detection. But it was uneventful, and we eventually wound up in New Zealand. And from New Zealand we went over to Australia.
Well, talking about non-eventual events, not eventful. There was one event that was surprising in your book when you crossed the international dateline. And I mean, crossed it from the northern hemisphere to the southern hemisphere, and you talked about, now what exactly was this, and you more or less were able to get back at the commissioned officers or whatever, because you said that everybody had to go through more or less a hazing thing.
Yes, we went through a hazing period. There seems to be, in the Navy especially, not so much the Air Force, there seemed to be a tradition that when you cross the international dateline, you had the equivalent of a fraternity-type hazing arrangement. And they would make the non-Navy personnel, of which I was one, the non-Navy personnel who had never crossed the dateline before, go through this hazing. And this hazing was typical fraternity-type stuff. I mean, it was making you swallow live small fish, not goldfish, but fish. And they would put you in a barrel of slime. They would blindfold you and drop you in a barrel of slime and things of that nature. They would make you go through a gauntlet of paddles and this type of thing. At one particular point in time, there was enough military personnel on board, and you have to admit that most of the military personnel had some degree of education, and they were all specialists in one form or another. And they weren't the type that would go through this hazing and sit down very quietly. So after 2 days of this hazing, we as a group got together and we forced the officers through the same hazing program.
Yeah.
And they didn't feel that we junior officers, so to speak, at that time I was a lieutenant, but the junior officers could ever do that to the captains and majors and the colonels, but we did. And that was quite eventful.
So it's more or less been being able to get back at the high...
Get the higher brass, but only through sheer numbers, not through rank. Now, during this hazing period, fortunately for the officers, your rank lost its identity. And you didn't have to worry about repercussions later on. Anything that was done during this hazing period was immediately forgotten. I mean, you could talk to an officer at that period of time, but you wouldn't dare talk to him later on in that same tone of voice, in that same manner. So by sheer numbers, there was enough of us that we then forced the officer command of the ship to go through the same hazing program.
Okay. So let's get to the point where you get to, well, first you got to New Zealand, and you were more or less put under command. I don't know where the base was in New Zealand, but you were put under the command of General George C. Kenney.
Right.
And where is this based at, or?
Well, in New Zealand was just a staging area for a matter of a day or two to get us off the vessel, get us organized, and some of them stayed. Keep in mind, there was a lot of different people aboard the ship. And the pilots, the co-pilots, the bombardiers, and the navigators were destined to go to northern Australia and eventually New Guinea. So those of us that was our destiny, and there were some 50, about 50 of us, we then went from New Zealand over to Sydney, Australia. Now, we went to Sydney only because it was the closest big city on the Australian continent adjacent to New Zealand. That was the shortest ocean voyage. So we then left there and went to Sydney. We spent a few days in Sydney, and we started up the east coast of Australia.
Now, isn't this the Barren Coast, or...?
No, the Barren Coast is the west coast.
The west, all right, this is the east.
The north and the west. So, but from Sydney, Australia, up to Melbourne, they're large cities. They're very, very big metropolitan cities. But there are no variety or cluster of cities between these two. So after you get north of Melbourne, Australia, from there on up the east coast, on north towards Japan and towards New Guinea, it's very barren. You can go fly through there for several days and not see anybody. So we actually, the last civilization, so to speak, north of Melbourne, Australia, literally was the Army camps that we're in the process of building, or the Air Force camps.
Okay. Well, what when you first in this spot in northern Australia where you were based?
Right.
Now, was this Moresby Base, or?
No, Port Moresby was actually the only U.S. held territory on the island of New Guinea. I was based in the most northern port of Australia, point of Australia, a little town called Townsville. Now, it was not a city. it was more or less like a small rural community that the U.S. Air Force had taken over and had appropriated the land and had built an airstrip.
Mm-hmm. And this was done under the 19th bombardment when they first
That's
went
right.
in?
That's right. The U.S. engineers, military engineers, and the 19th bombardment group had carved this piece out of the so-called the jungle of Northern Australia's primary all jungle. It's not too much different than any other jungle. And so they had taken this piece of real estate on Northern Australia so that we could house our troops, Air Force troops, and our military planes so that we could fly our bombing missions against the Japanese from that base. Now, why from Northern Australia? At that time, Japan had taken over all the islands south of Japan and were on the verge of invading Australia. So, therefore, we were assigned to that spot to fly our missions out of there and to bomb all the shipping channels coming into Northern Australia, literally to protect Australia. The first 5 or 6 months of the war that I was involved with over there was primarily for the protection of Australia from being invaded by Japan. And now, how did we hope to protect them? We hoped to protect them by going out and finding their military transport vessels and their bombardment vessels and bomb those vessels and sink them before they could arrive at the coast of Australia. And that's literally what we did. And after we had done that for several months to where Northern Australia became fairly secure, we moved to the only non-continent base we had over there, and that was one city, one little town in New Guinea called Port Moresby. Okay. Japanese held all of Port Moresby for one town. So after we secured, in effect, the fact that Northern Australia was not going to be invaded by the Japanese troops, we moved over to Port Moresby. And the purpose of going to Port Moresby was to get a little bit closer with our planes so that we had deranged to bomb some of the Japanese outposts, such as Rabaul and so forth.
Okay. Let's talk about Port Moresby now. What was the place like, and did you have to build the airstrip yourself, or...?
Port Moresby was an Aboriginal village. Outside of the U.S. military people, primarily Air Force people, and some U.S. military engineers that helped us build the base, there were literally no, as we might call them, civilians. There was no industry, of course, and the fruits there, they grew fruits, bananas and coconuts and so forth that the Aborigines lived on. There were a few Australians there, but civilian Australians under control of the military government Australia to help us, to show us around and to help us. But primarily Port Moresby was just a small Aborigine community taken over by the U.S. government so we could station some planes there.
Did you have any trouble by the Papuans that live there? Or?
Not really, in that we had so many things that the Papuans had never seen that they were very friendly to us, and a string of beads, a glass of milk, a glass of orange juice could make them your friend forever. And so although we didn't have many luxuries there, anything we had, if we shared it a little bit with the native population, they would do almost anything for us. Now, I have to describe Port Moresby to you. You know, Port Moresby is a city in New Guinea. Now, New Guinea itself is not a very big island. And Port Moresby was the only Allied-held territory, non-Japanese-held territory in the entire South Pacific at that time. So we actually went in and carved this area out of the jungle. The military command housed themselves in grass huts that we had the Papuans build for us. The soldiers and the few sailors and the Australians and the pilots, such as myself, we literally lived in small pup tents. We had no barracks, no dormitories, and we did not have any dining halls. So we had what we called field kitchens, which was primarily a trailer that they hauled out there with propane burners on it that cooked our food. And we slept in small one-man pup tents, almost like a little Boy Scout tent. And that was our total living conditions the entire time we were at Port Moresby. Now I'm talking about in 1942. Later on, when the military got in there and we expanded our base, they brought in supplies and built some barracks and so forth. But at that time, we literally lived, many of us actually slept in our own airplanes or on the ground under the airplanes. The Japanese at that time were so close to us that at night they would infiltrate our campgrounds and be no more than 50 or 60 feet, not yards, away. For an alarm system we had rigged up around our airplanes to protect them from sabotage by the Japanese. The only alarm system we had at that time was a series of stakes with strings strung between these stakes and tied with tin cans with stones in them. So if the Japanese would stumble in the dark over one of these strings or cans, it would rattle a noise and we could alert ourselves to try to protect our planes. Actually, there were so few bombers available at that time. Each one became very precious. I think at the time I was in Port Moresby, the entire Allied force of bombers, B-17 long-range bombers, which was the biggest bomber that the U.S. government had, were only 23 in the entire South Pacific, in that area. So they were very precious to us. We couldn't afford any sabotage. Okay. Very primitive living conditions at Port Moresby.
Now, was a flying fortress a B-17 or?
A flying fortress was a B-17, yes. Okay. The U.S. Military had one other four-engine bomber, and they called that a B-24 Liberator. However, at that time in the South Pacific, we did not have any of those. We had the B-17 flying fortresses, which, by the way, was the largest plane in the military command.
Okay, let's talk about some of these missions that you did fly. And most of them did more or less concentrate on hitting Rabaul.
Yes.
And which was the main Japanese land post at that time?
Supply post. And keep in mind, it was too far from Japan. Japan had tried to dominate so much territory in the South Pacific that they had difficulty with their supply lines. Now they had plenty of manpower, plenty of airplanes, and plenty of ships. But keep in mind, they were getting pretty far away from home, trying to keep those areas supplied. So what they had done, they had taken over this area of Rabaul, and they used that as a depot. So they would fly and transport their supplies out of Japan to Rabaul, then actually conduct the war in the entire South Pacific from Rabaul. They had that Rabaul Harbor had as many as 90 in 100 Japanese vessels of all types in there all the time, and just hundreds and hundreds of their military planes on the ground in Rabaul. They could not fly from Japan over to Guadalcanal or over to New Guinea or back over to the Philippines. It was too far. They needed a staging area, and Rabaul was their staging area. Now, we had many Japanese targets. We had Japanese targets. It was only 50 miles away from our base. But it became more important, since we have such a limited number of aircraft and a limited number of pilots, we didn't want to waste our bombs on a small Japanese settlement someplace, or one or two vessels. So we made the 800-mile trip in one way to Rabaul, and if we ever successfully got over Rabaul and could drop our bombs, then we couldn't miss. There was such a concentration of military equipment and manpower that you couldn't miss. So we did more good by flying 800 miles away than we were going to the targets were only 40, 50 miles away. That was the secret of us flying to Rabaul all the time. We hit the hub of the wheel as opposed to one of the spokes of the rim.
Okay, could you pinpoint some of the major missions you did with under the 19th bombardment? More or less tracing a couple of the milk runs or?
Well, I think the most mission that I had, memorable mission I had, was that the Japanese decided to launch a massive invasion of Guadalcanal and a second attempt at Northern Australia. And they had amassed in Rabaul just hundreds and hundreds of warships. I'm talking about troop transports as well as their cruisers and destroyers, as soon as I can. We were constantly watching for when are they going to make this move. Apparently, although I was not related to intelligence, so I really don't know, but apparently our intelligence was unable to determine when they planned to make their move again. And so then they sent us military pilots out to shadow them. So we used to fly on these so-called milk runs up in the area of Rabaul. Try to conserve our fuel and just fly around for hours looking down, not attempting on some cases to bomb a target, but to plot their activities. Well, on this one mission, I happened to see this large convoy of Japanese vessels, battleships, destroyers, cruisers, and probably 15 or 20 troop transports heading south. When I say heading south, I meant towards New Guinea and towards Australia. Now, what their true intent was, we don't know, but they were headed our way, so to speak. So then I shadowed those as long as I could, and then went back with my report. Keep in mind, we didn't have the radio communications that we have today. We had some radio, but the range of the radio was not great enough for us to communicate back with Port Moresby from in the area of Rabaul. So our most reliable transmissions was to follow these movements as long as we could, then hurry back and tell what we knew to another group of pilots. So I can recall seeing this group of Japanese military vessels assembled, and we followed them for about 7 or 8 hours, staying out of sight where they couldn't see us, but we could see them. We'd dart in and out of the clouds, get a look at them, and go back in the clouds. If you stayed where they could see you, they could come up and shot us down. They could put, where they were, they could put 200-300 zeros in the air in a matter of 15 or 20 minutes. So you couldn't fly in an exposed condition. You had to fly on instruments in the clouds all the time. So we'd dart out of the clouds till we see what they were going. So we used to plot their movements. And I was lucky enough to see that group leave Rabaul and heading south. And I shadowed them as long as I could until our fuel became low and I had to go back. And then when I went back, they sent another plane out to shadow them for a while. That second plane couldn't find them. You have to keep in mind, in the South Pacific, it's a tropical climate. It rains sometime every day. It's very warm, very turbulent in the skies. And there's clouds all the time. Now they come and go. So the second plane they sent out couldn't find them. Keep in mind, you're trying to find this group in the Pacific Ocean. So I was asked to go back out again after about 5 hours on the ground, and we were lucky enough to find them when we shadowed them another 6 or 8 hours. Where as a result of that intelligence report that we turned in, we had 4 days to assemble all the aircraft we could find. They called in aircraft and ships from all over the world that they could get there that fast. Now, that wasn't too far away. And as a result, we were able to mount an air attack against that Japanese convoy and wipe them out. Now, not me, but we, the entire Air Force on it. So actually, we're able to stop that convoy from reaching New Guinea and reaching Northern Australia. And that in itself just may have turned the tide of the war because they were in complete control. You can well imagine, had the Japanese landed in Australia, we wouldn't have had any place to launch our war from. Hawaii is too far away.
Okay.
That's the secret of Australia. That was our launching pad and the only place where friendly troops could assemble to put a counterattack back against the Japanese.
Another question. Let's talk about the Japanese. Were there any Japanese air squadrons that the 19th bombardment feared or were amazed with?
Not particularly. We feared them all, of course. But there was none more than others because the Japanese pilots were very dedicated. And as you've since read, and we learned by first-hand experience, that they would take risks that we couldn't take. Number one, they were dedicated to give their lives for the emperor, and they flew that way. They were very reckless. They would fly up to, and I can recall very vividly, I keep in mind I'm the pilot of a bomber, and when you're on a bombing run, you have to hold a steady, steady course, and you can't have any abrupt movements in your plane, or the bombardier was going to miss his target with the bombs. So no matter what is happening around you, you have to not close your eyes to it, but you have to block it out and stay on your bombing run. I can recall very vividly where these Japanese fighter pilots would fly right into you, roll over on their back, shooting at you all the time, and get within 8 or 9 feet and pull away from you. Now, we American pilots couldn't afford to do that. We had to value our aircraft more than that. We didn't have that many. We had to be constantly thinking about, if I lose this airplane, then we won't have any airplanes to fight with. That was our primary consideration. The Japanese had plenty of aircraft. They became very reckless. And if they couldn't shoot you down, they'd often ram you. Well, we may have wanted to ram somebody. I don't know if we had the courage to do that or not. But even if we did have the courage, we wouldn't have done it because we were protecting the numbers of aircraft we had. We had so few. So yes, they were a very aggressive group of people and very brave people, and well trained. I personally hated the Japanese, but by the same token, I had to admire their skills.
So when did you change from the 19th bombardment to the 43? You mentioned that the 19th went back, but you stayed on with the 43.
The 19th bombardment group was the first heavy bombardment group to go into South Pacific. They had been in the Philippines as a bombardment group during peacetime. And when war was declared, as you know, we were chased out of the Philippines fairly quick. So the 19th bombardment group then went to Northern Australia, where I joined them. Now this group had been assembled for several years, and actually had been fighting the war since December the 7th. Until I joined them in, July or August of 1943. They weren't that large, and they had lost in the early part of the war a lot of their pilots and a lot of their planes. And actually, the 19th Bombardment Group had become to where they were a good, dedicated group of people, but their numbers were diminishing through casualties. And so when the numbers got down so low, they brought in another bombardment group from the United States called the 44th, 3rd Bombardment Group, and absorbed the remnants of the 19th Bombardment Group, such as myself, into it. There wasn't enough of us left in the 19th Bombardment Group to conduct a war.
Okay.
So we were absorbed into the 43rd.
Well, you mentioned in part of your book that when you talked about fears, that you seemed to fear more of being shot down over the jungle than being captured by the Japanese. Now, why is this?
You didn't want either, of course.
Yeah.
But if you had to make a choice, many of us preferred, at least we indicated we preferred, to be captured by the Japanese as opposed to being shot down over the jungle. Because survival in the tropical jungle would have been totally impossible. With the Japanese, at least you had a chance that they may treat you right and keep you alive. We had a number of people, of our pilots, that had to bail out over the jungle. And there was just no way that they could ever get back. First of all, much of it was swampy, much of it was alligator infested. And deeper in the jungle were hostile Aborigines. The Japanese had been there and had, in effect, bribed the local natives to turn in any American pilots they found, dead or alive. And the Aborigines would kill you if they found you just to take your weapons and to take your shoes and to take your coat and your hat. Mm. So actually, our theory was, and thank God many of us never had to make that choice, that if the Japanese captured us, you had a chance. If you went down in the jungle, you didn't have a chance at all.
All right, let's go on to more or less the aspects of this point at Port Moresby. Now, you mentioned some people called Fuzzies and Woolwells. Now, were these the people that lived in the area?
They were the Aboriginal natives. And the Fuzzies primarily were the male population, and the Lulabelles were the females. They were truly natives. Very, very primitive. They could climb trees almost like monkeys. They had no clothing except the loincloth. Later on in the war, they wound up with bits and pieces of clothing, but they considered them as trophies that they got from the Americans. Their diet was principally melons that they grew, coconuts and bananas that were native to that country.
Mm-hmm. Were they able to help you at all in the for living conditions or anything? Or
they were a very tricky people, in that they blew back and forth with the wind. Those of them close to our particular camp at Port Moresby would do us many favors and would work, do the manual work for us in helping us clear little roads and the airstrips. However, the Japanese were only 30 or 40 miles away with a base. And if the Japanese would get to them, why, they would change their allegiance overnight for a trophy or a trinket. So they were undependable. They were not hostile to the point, at least in the area around Port Moresby, where I don't think they would ever murdered any of the Americans. But they would tell the Japanese all about our installation. So they were unreliable more than they were vicious.
Okay, let's go back to the missions with the 43rd. Could you describe the Battle of Bismarck?
Yes, I flew several missions in the Battle of the Bismarck Sea. And the Battle of the Bismarck Sea is where they had this Japanese armada moving in on us.
Mm-hmm. Now, what point of the war was this? Is this?
This was in mid-1943.
Okay.
And here again, the Japanese were trying to literally chase the Allies out of that hemisphere. And had they been able to chase us out of Australia, then the closest place would have been thousands of miles away from Japan. There would have been no threat of bombing Japan or an invasion of Japan or taking back many of those islands they'd taken from us if we did not have a foothold in Australia. So they were preoccupied over trying to get the Australians, the few that were there, and the Americans out of that area of the world. So they had this Japanese armada in the Battle of the Bismarck Sea descending on, we don't know what their target was, but headed south. And that could have been our port at Port Moresby, that could have been our airfield at Guadalcanal, or it could have been the Australian continent. So, of course, our objective in the Battle of the Bismarck Sea is don't let them get too close. Wipe them out before they can get that far. And so we mustered every pilot we had and every airplane we had. Some of them not mechanically sound, but would fly, because we knew this was the last ditch stand. We either knocked them out on their way down there, or else we had to get out. So as a result, all of the crews, talking about the gunners, I'm talking about the flight attendants, I'm talking about the maintenance men, I'm talking about the pilots, the bombardiers, and the navigators, we flew continuous missions. We would load up with bombs and fly out over this Japanese armada and drop our bombs trying to sink some of their vessels. That's all we were after at that time. Now, they had many aircraft carriers in that armada, but we weren't particularly after them. We wanted the troop transports. That's the people that was going to hurt us, were the troops that were going to take over Australia or New Guinea, not their airplanes. So even though if we saw three vessels in a row, and I as a pilot had my choice, which one am I going to drop my bombs on, we would take the troop transport. Not that we weren't concerned with the human life aboard that troop transport, but they were the very soldiers who were going to fight us hand to hand later on if they landed. So we flew mission after mission and literally wiped out that armada. Now, during the process of bombing them, we were not unmolested. They had aircraft carriers, and these aircraft carriers were had many zero aircraft aboard. So while we were trying to bomb those vessels out of the ocean, of course we were being attacked in the air by the Japanese fighter planes, which was called a zero. And they were a highly maneuverable plane, very, very good pilots, which made our mission quite difficult. But it was really almost, although you were in the air, it was almost hand-to-hand combat. I can remember vividly looking out the windshield of my plane, and I could describe the features of that Japanese pilot in a fighter plane. That's how close you were.
So they were just right outside you?
Right outside.
Okay. Probably the most vivid chapter in your book deals with a mission that was called the Flying Holocaust. And could you more or less go into detail on that?
Well, now keep in mind that you're going back 35 years or more. I don't know, are you returning to the mission where the where we were hit by an anti-aircraft shell in the Bombay?
Right.
Yeah. Yes, I can describe that one because it was rather frightening. Although, strange as it may seem, you are not frightened at the time. You're frightened when you get home, when you get back. And I don't recall that I was frightened to where I couldn't perform my duties, because I think the shock hits you later on, like when you're back at base or when the thing is quieted down. But we were on a bombing run over a Japanese transport vessel loaded with troops, and it was accompanied by a couple of destroyers. I'm not too sure there wasn't a battleship in that small convoy. And while we were making our bombing run with the bomb bay doors open, of course, the anti-aircraft batteries aboard their battleships and destroyers were firing at us. Now, of course, you can't hear them because of the noise of your own propellers in your plane. But you can see when those anti-aircraft shells explode, you can see them outside the wings of your plane and make a big puff of smoke as they explode. And you can feel the remnants of the shrapnel bouncing off your plane and hitting your plane. So you can hear it and you can feel it. You can hear the your plane being hit, but you can't hear the explosion. But you see the white puffs of smoke. So you can really tell as they're tracking you. You're flying and they're tracking you with their guns. You can see them get closer and closer because as you look out the window, you see a puff of smoke here, then you see another getting closer, another getting closer. They're finding you. And you see that by these puffs of smoke. Well, actually, then we were hit in the bomb bay by an aircraft shell and started a fire. Now I have to go back. Before you start a bombing run, you go through a procedure of what you call arming your bombs. That is literally you pull the firing pin, and when you do that, you're at the point of no return. You can't take that bomb back home. You can't land that plane with that firing pin pulled. It will explode on the impact of landing. Any slight jar will cause that bomb to detonate. So we had, before you start your bombing run, naturally you have to arm all those bombs. Well, we were in that condition when we were hit by that anti-aircraft shell that tore the whole front nose off the plane and started a fire down in the bomb bay and in the nose of the plane. Well, as I recall, we went to then, when we saw that fire, to jettison the bombs. Not worry about hitting a target. We were worried about saving the plane. So we pulled what we call the salvo handle, which is an automatic release for all those bombs to fall. They wouldn't release, it was jammed due to the aircraft fire and the damage it had done in there. And so then our bombardier from the nose of the plane, who sat in the nose of the plane, walked back, and he started to beat this fire out with his clothing, jackets and so forth. And then our co-pilot crawled out of his seat alongside him, and he went down into the bomb bay area and tried to beat this fire out. And finally, they was able to manually, among all those flames, And that open Bombay, now it's open. One mismove and that have fallen down into the ocean. They were able to salvo those bombs manually, but the fire had done a great deal of damage. And the most pitiful part of that entire mission was the fact that the co-pilot, a fellow by the name of John Gibbs, who was an accomplished pilot in his own, crawled back up into the pilot seat, co-pilot seat, and his arms were literally burned to a crisp up to his elbows. And he had to sit that way for 4 hours till we got back to base in his burnt flesh. Now, in the meantime, I had been hit by, I don't know whether by an aircraft fire or a gunshot from a Zero fighter plane, hit in the leg. And my leg, we wore sheepskin boots that come up just below the knees because we flew at high altitudes. And even though it was 120 degrees on the ground, it might have been only 15 or 16 degrees where we were. So we wore sheepskin clothing for the high altitude when we had to go that high. And my boot actually had filled up with blood, and my leg was numb. And I really wanted to scream and cry and complain, but when I looked over and saw the condition the poor co-pilot was in, I didn't have the guts to say anything. Now, the sad part of that flight was that when we got back to Port Moresby, keep in mind we're landing on primitive-type airfields. We're not looking at O'Hare National Airport with runways 5 miles long and a half a mile wide. We're looking on primitive runways with very little clearance to get in and get out of it. And most of the runways were made from these steel landing type mats that they laid down or just on the ground. So we got to Port Moresby, we found that our hydraulic system had been all shot out. And therefore, we had no hydraulic control of the plane function. Now, the aileron of the plane and the flaps of the plane are all run hydraulically. We couldn't control those. So normally, I can't recall now, 35 years later, our landing speed, but let's assume that it was our normal landing speed might have been about 90 to 100 miles an hour. Since we didn't have flaps and we didn't have ailerons, we had to attempt to land at about 170 miles an hour, something like that. And therefore, we had no brakes. So we flew, made about two passes at the fields, and I wanted to make a third one, but I saw all the crew members were shot up, and the co-pilot was literally burned to a crisp. So we made a shot at the landing field, and when we come down on the landing field, we went clear down there, and then I had to put power on it and turn around and go back down. Couldn't get stopped because there were no brakes.
So that was more or less the last terrifying mission that you had to do before going home. And
yes, and the fact that it wasn't so much the bombing mission over the Japanese vessels, but the fact that the plane was damaged so badly that we didn't know if we were going to get back. And even that was not so critical as the fact that the crew members, some of them were shot up, and as I say, the co-pilot was burned very, very badly. And the only reason he was burned so badly, he was really trying to save the rest of his crew members, because if they hadn't got that fire out, well, the whole plane would have caught fire and would all been gone. So he literally, it was a sacrifice on his part, which made the rest of us feel probably more deeply than we would have felt. He was just trying to save the rest of the crew. But as I, in repeating, then when we got back, well, we landed much, much too fast because we didn't have hydraulic service and didn't have any brakes. And literally, we had as big a scare on the ground as we did in the air. We had radioed in when we became close to Port Moresby that we had an emergency on board and asked them to clear the runway and give us clear passage, make sure there was no other planes down there. We were in a hurry. And word had spread through the camp there that we were in deep trouble and coming back. And then a lot of the native villagers. And so what they had actually done, everyone had lined up alongside the runway, which actually handicapped us. Because when we got the plane on the ground with no brakes, we couldn't stop it. And in order to keep from running off into a marsh, we had to keep giving it more power on two propellers or the other two propellers to turn it. The only way we could steer it or guide it was through the use of propellers and a little more power to the engines. Well, every time we did that, we gained a little more velocity. Well, we looked around and there was people lined up on both sides of the runway and didn't give us any room to maneuver. So that was probably the most difficult time we had, any one single time here. A
couple other questions. You mentioned in the book that a lot of the Japanese dropped the American propaganda leaflets.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what was this in? Was this addressed to the Australians or?
No, it was. They were addressed to the American troops. And the leaflets were to the effect, but by the same token, we dropped leaflets on the Japanese as well, many times. And matter of fact, I think probably in the book I may have an example of one or two of the leaflets we dropped. But the leaflets the Japanese dropped were to the effect that, look, your commanders have put you out here, you don't have a chance to survive, they're sacrificing you, why don't you give up? That was the theme or the tone of what they were telling us. They were indicating that, look, there's no other Americans around, there's no other allies around. They put you few people up here at Port Moresby. We're within 35 or 40 miles from you. We can come and get you anytime we want you. You've been sacrificed. Now, in other words, your own American government has abandoned you. Why don't you give up? That was the tone.
Did this bother anybody? Or?
Not really. At least to my knowledge, it didn't bother anybody. And at, keep in mind, we at the same time were dropping, when we would fly over a ball, we were dropping leaflets with the same type of message, saying that Japan cannot win this war, and even though you feel you have a few victories now, you're eventually going to lose the war, and we're going to recapture all these South Pacific islands. So it was a war of propaganda, so to speak. I don't think it had any real effect. We used to be able to listen to the broadcasts of Tokyo Rose, and I have to assess from the attitude of the people that I was with that they laughed about it more than they worried about it. It was more or less a joke.
Okay. There's a couple questions I'd like. It has to do with censorship.
Mm-hmm.
And was there much censorship out of your book after you had it done?
There was a, I wouldn't say an excessive amount, but there was probably 20% of what I had to say was censored, and I understood it, and actually we felt it would be, simply because the war was still in progress. When I came back, see, I went overseas in mid-1943. And the war was in its infancy in the Pacific. And I had been shot up a couple of times and several planes banged up and served my time. And I was released, I think it was 1 year later, of 1943. I came back to the States. Not released from the service. Mm-hmm. But I'd reached the point where I had picked up a lot of the tropical, I wasn't ill. But I had become subject to a lot of the tropical infections. I had served all my missions. Mm-hmm. And apparently someone thought, well, he's reaching a point of battle fatigue. Although I didn't feel that way. So in effect, they said, well, look, you've had your crack at this combat. Now let's give somebody else a turn. You go on home. So they sent me on home, and I became a squadron commander in training pilots and crews in B-17s to go to England. So they sent me to Dyersburg, Tennessee, and I was a squadron commander with an entire training squadron, flight training squadron, in Dyersburg, Tennessee. Well, I'd been there for a short while when the U.S. government had placed a lot of demands on the civilian aircraft companies who were hauling a lot of supplies overseas. And so the Trans World Airlines, TWA, was in desperate need of pilots. They had planes and they had these military contracts and they couldn't fulfill them. And so they had appealed to the military for some pilots. And so a few of us who had been overseas and served our missions, our combat missions, were given the opportunity to fly for TWA as a commercial pilot. And if we would sign a contract to fly as a commercial pilot, they would then release us from the military. Well, I was never really a career military man. First of all, it was serving my purposes to get an education and get some training, and later on we had a war, and I think I was sort of gung-ho. I wanted to do my part. But nevertheless, after I'd done my part, I didn't want to make the military a career. So when I was given this opportunity to fly commercial aviation and then be released from the service, I accepted it. So I was actually released from the service and signed a contract with Trans World Airline. So then I flew as a commercial pilot for TWA, and I was domiciled in Kansas City, Missouri, and flew from Kansas City to Los Angeles. That run, in fact. And I flew commercially then as a commercial pilot until 1946. And then I left that to take up where I left off back in my college education, which was in metallurgy and mechanical engineering, and went to work in that field and for industry.
Well, can you pinpoint any specific incidents of censorship that you could say now that you couldn't say then?
Well, my memory is getting a little fry. I can give you general recollections. The details I don't recall, but I know I did when I dictated for the book.
How about page 58?
We were, I'm talking here about a way of locating enemy convoys.
Right.
And of course, the only publicized way at that time of locating enemy convoys was through what we call the milk runs, or shadowing them. At this time in the war, we were much further along with our sonar devices than we led the Japanese to believe. And our sonar devices were actually operational at that time. But nobody knew they were operational. And therefore, I knew they were operational. But I couldn't talk about them. Uh-huh. So I dictated some information into the notes for my book concerning the sonar. But then they were deleted from the book. And I understand why. Mm-hmm. I think that was the right thing for them to do.
Was there any other examples, or?
Yes, we had some examples. In fact, I had some notes that I put a caption around and indicated they were not to be used without checking back with me in any manuscripts for the book. And that was actually that we had some men, American pilots, who bailed out of their military aircraft over Rabaul. They escaped detection, and they lived as a community of five men, two pilots, a navigator, a bombardier, and one enlisted man escaped out of this B-17 that had 11 people on. And they were able to salvage the radio out of their B-17, and they were able to get messages right out from under the Japanese at Rabaul. Now keep in mind, Rabaul is the staging area for the Japanese to conduct the war, and we had five American Air Force people in Rabaul sending messages. Now we were too far away at Port Moresby to get those messages, but our aircraft on their bombing runs, as they neared Rabaul, could pick up pieces of those messages, and enough pieces that we knew some of the ship movements going out of Rabaul. Now, these five people had no intelligence, but they were in an area where they could see the vessels arriving and the vessels departing. And they could see the deployment of all the military aircraft and tell us whether they were going north, east, south, or west. They never knew what they were up to. But that, plus we knew elsewhere, we put the pieces together. So that was naturally edited out of here. I had information on that that couldn't be used. And here again, I fully understood. If we'd have let the Japanese know through this book somehow that we had five people in Rabaul, well, you know what would have happened. They'd have gone looking for them, and I'd eventually found them.
Well, do you think the Japanese ever got a hold of the book, or?
Oh, I don't know. By the time the book was published, anything I was saying was passé. The war had progressed very rapidly. Keep in mind that in 1941, when war was declared, we were very poorly prepared. We didn't have any aircraft to speak of, military aircraft. We
had very few naval vessels. We didn't have any trained people. The American Ingenuity did a very good job, but it took almost a year before we had any numbers of anything. So keep in mind, I'm referring to the war back in the primitive stages when we didn't have many of anything. And by the time my book was written and published, our industrial complex had produced so much war material that it changed the complexion of the war completely.
Okay, a couple other. Well, since you were back in the States by 1945, how was your reaction to the bomb when Hiroshima and Nagasaki? And more or less, do you think the war would have gone on that much longer if we wouldn't have done it?
Oh, I think probably, from my limited point of view, I think probably that was the turning point of the war. And it was more psychological than it was anything else. I think the real damage that we did when we bombed Japan was negligible. I'm not talking about the, I'm talking about Doolittle's first bombing raid, and not the dropping of the atom bomb that came after.
Oh, okay.
But let's take the first bombing raid over Japan. If you recall, General Doolittle had taken some bombers off the deck of an aircraft carrier, which was unheard of. Fighter planes, yes. Bombers, no. Bombers are normally too big to go off the deck of an aircraft. And when he flew over Japan and dropped those bombs, it did very little damage, but psychologically it shook the Japanese. See, the Japanese thought that they're thousands of miles away from everybody. There's no enemy plane ever going to reach their shores. And basically they were right. Well, then when General Doolittle, although it cost a lot of planes, a lot of people lost their lives, psychologically, that turned the thing around. And the Japanese population then began to have second thoughts about the war. Before, they were all for Hirohito. He was their savior. At that point in time, many of them began to doubt the Emperor of Japan. And of course, that was climax then. And even the atom bomb. Horrible damage, no question. But that bombing raid in itself didn't do enough damage to change the complexion of the war. It changed the psychological attitude of people toward the war. Japanese then knew that they could be hurt in this war and they could lose the war. That's the first time they realized that could happen. And here again, although you know of the cities that were bombed out, but you need to bomb out more than two or three cities to win a war. So it was a psychology thing, and that was really the turning point. And I think that was a masterpiece on our part. And I admired Harry Truman, President Harry Truman, for having the courage to go in and drop that bomb. Many people have criticized our president for that. But when you criticize, you have to remember this. We were losing Marines and sailors and airmen by the thousands on all those little islands down in the Pacific. Thousands of them. So what are we going to do, be a gentleman and let them die every day and not bother Japan? So no, I think that was the only thing to do. I think in the end, he saved more lives by far.
Are there any additional comments you'd like to make about your book, or?
No, Mark, I want to apologize for my incoherent rambling here, in that this information was compiled by me back in 1941, 1942, and 1943, and that's some 35 years, so I...
So did you keep a diary at all when you were over there? Or?
No, you raised that question before, and I apologize for not having answered it completely, and I think I went off on a tangent. Now, what had happened, if you recall, I indicated that there weren't too many pilots over there fighting the war. And those of us who went over weren't sent over because we were the best. We were the only ones they had, good, bad, or indifferent. And since there were so few, and we did need something to feed the American public as to about what was going on in the war, if they wanted to report a bombing raid over Rabaul, they only had maybe on any given day 15 or 16 people they could talk to. I happened to be one of them. As a result of that, my name kept cropping up frequently in the American papers. And with all the papers in the United States and with all the porters around, there's only 15 or 16 people that they're going to get anything from. So what the reporters would do, they would hang around, in effect, our dispatching area.
where a flight squadron flew from. And they'd see which pilots were leaving on a bombing run and which came back and which didn't come back, and they'd write about it. Someone's 15 planes went out and 8 come back, they'd report that 7 were missing. And they'd report some names if they were allowed to. Then of the 8 that come back, well, they'd try to say, well, where did you go, and so forth. So it was a matter of numbers. Hello. I suppose okay. We're about wrapped up on it.
Yeah. Okay, who more or less motivated you to write the book? Or?
Well, a lot of the news clippings that were printed, of course, I was not aware of them over there. I didn't see these news clippings. But they were being accumulated back here in the States by my brother-in-law. And he had a collection of these news clippings for that period of time. And as a result, these news clippings, in effect, formed a diary, an unofficial diary. So it was a case of sorting out these news clippings and reconstructing the intervening events. And that was the basis of the book.
Okay.